Dear Ajahn, in silence, there is a strong, perpetual, continuous background sound. What is it? Is it okay to put my attention on that rather than the breath? It's in the silence, you can sort of perceive like a sound if you wish to, but that is actually counterproductive because it makes it difficult to let go of the sound. So the whole idea of silence is not paying attention to the audio apparatus of your body and your brain so it can disappear. There's always a feeling in the body, even if it's a comfortable feeling, even though the body feels just so nice. But the purpose is that when it's comfortable, it's very easy to let it go. When you look at the past, there's always something there. But the point is that we try and let go of the past and the future. So all sound just vanishes. There was a Hindu meditation of the sound of silence, but that wasn't taught by the Buddha. So my advice would be, in the silence, let it really be silent. So there's nothing at all. And then it can totally vanish. And that is one of the signs of the deep meditation. You can actually get into meditation, you're here, and you don't hear the bell, you don't hear people coming and going. There is the story of the little novice monk in Thailand a long time ago. And it's a very beautiful story. This little novice, you know the case in Asia, sometimes if a person has unwanted children or they cannot maintain the child, they can sometimes send them to a monastery or a temple where they get looked after enough so they can get a good education. They usually, when they get 16 or 17, then they can leave. It was like a social safety net in the old days. So there was this young novice who was at Wat Bapol. And one evening, when Ajahn Chah was given his Dhamma talks, Ajahn Chah went on and on and on and on and on. And sometimes Ajahn Chah actually did that. Sometimes he would just talk all night. And I remember I didn't get into the beginning of the talk, and I was waiting, I didn't want to disturb anybody, waiting for everybody to come out. It started about 9 o'clock, and it didn't finish till 2. And I remember one of the monks coming out and said, "Ajahn Chah's crazy, he's nuts." As a senior disciple as well, he got really upset. Because sometimes the talks which you see translated into books, you know, by Ajahn Chah, I compare it to, you know, you're digging for gold or diamonds, and most of the stuff, you know, is just not really useful, but you wait and wait and wait until you get something which is really worth all that waiting for. Those little, literally, nuggets of wisdom, those little diamonds, you know, in the rest of the useless stuff. And that's what it was like with Ajahn Chah. Sometimes it'd go on forever. And anyway, this was one of those times. He was talking, 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 talking. And this little novice was getting more and more fed up. Because, and he's only a little fellow, it's okay for these, you know, big monks, you know, who actually decided to go and stay with him. The little novice didn't really have much choice. So the little novice, after an hour, started thinking, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is he going to stop? And in those old days, when there were those vinyl records, when there's a scratch there, it gets into a groove, it keeps repeating itself. And that was like the little novice's mind. When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When's he going to stop? When's he going to stop? When's he going to stop? And an insight happened. It's like putting things the opposite way around. And then he suddenly had this thought, when am I going to stop? And the little novice stopped. And when he opened his eyes after blissing out for many hours, it was light, the dawn had come, and all the monks had bowed. They always do some chanting at the end of those talks, got up their mats and gone back to bed. And he hadn't heard anything of that. That was a sign that he had a very good meditation. He enjoyed himself immensely. And the sign, one of the signs was you couldn't hear anything. So when we have sound of silence, if it's sound, it's not silent. If it's silent, it's not sound. It's one of those oxymorons, which, you know, sounds deep, but when you imagine it, when you examine it, this is not just what silence truly is. Silence, everything disappears. Sounds vanish. You can't hear anything. So that's wonderful when that happens, because a lot of our attention to that sense base of sound is based on fear. Because sound is what tells us that someone is creeping up behind us to attack us. It is sound is what you see, hear the burglar coming into your house. It is sound which thinks there's a ghost coming. And it is sound which you use to wake you up in the morning with the alarm bell, or me with the, it's not a bell, it's like one of these little singing bells, the gongs. That's actually what you hear. And it's also the case that people in comas, I think you know who I'm talking about, who is the sound of a temple bell, brought her out of the coma. So if someone is very deep, you know, either in meditation or some bodily trauma, it's a sound which actually the last thing which you will let go of before you pass away. It's the first thing which actually can bring you out afterwards if you're in some trauma. The kind sounds. So that is why it's hard to let go of sounds. But they disappear. So don't listen to any humming sound, because that will keep you on that sense base and you won't enjoy the beauty of having one less sound to worry about. Or one less sense to worry about. One of the jobs of the five meditation is to five senses totally vanish. Oh, what bliss. So, I would not put your attention on that sound. I wouldn't put my attention on the breath. I would let the mind choose. So, whatever's in front of me is the most important thing in the whole world. Whatever that is. I'm not going to choose to watch any sound. I'm not going to choose at all. Whatever it is in front of me right now, what I watch. Now is the most important time. I'm not worrying about where I'm going to have my attention next moment. And I'm just kind. It's a kindness which calms things down. Ajahn Brahm, our stream enterers, once returners, incapable of hurting others by words or deeds, do their personalities change completely once they attain those levels? The answer is no, they are capable of hurting or offending others. One of those, even the Arahant Mahakasapa, he really offended Ananda. And Ananda got really fed up with Federal Kasapa once. But it's if stream enterers, non-returners, if they do make any mistake, well, they usually just own up to it, they confess to it, because they know there's no self inside to be blamed or to be punished. So there's no sense of, like, guilt. It's one of the reasons why I encourage people, you know, in some of the public talks which I give, or in marriages, or in how to bring up children. If you are afraid of your parents, You will never actually go to ask them when you are in big trouble. And what the example here was that many years ago at our centre in Perth, a young Sri Lankan girl came up to see me. She said, "I'm in big trouble. I'm pregnant." And I asked her, "Have you told your mum and dad yet?" They've been coming to the temple since they were really small. And so, you know, the parents knew me, trusted me. She'd grown up there in the temple. I've been in Perth now about 34 years now, I think, 35. Quite a long time now. But anyway, a lot of, you know, people grown up with me, they see me when I used to be thin. And anyway, and I said, "Have you told your parents yet?" He said, "No, that's the point. They'd kill me when they find out I'm pregnant. And I'm not married with my boyfriend. That's why I've come to you, Ajahn Brahm. Can you tell them for me, please?" And, you know, I was both touched, you know, the trust and, you know, the fact you could do some nice service, get her out of trouble, and also a bit concerned that why are you so afraid of telling your parents? And I was touched and I could actually help out. Because, you know, the parents trusted me, she trusted me. Oh, come on, people make mistakes. You know, with the best will in the world, you know, your kids aren't perfect, you're not perfect either. And so we do make mistakes, and when we make mistakes, why can't we tell people? We're afraid. And so I told the parents, like, come on, give her a break. She needs your help, not, you know, be afraid of you. Or if you have a son who's got involved in drugs or something, you know, would they be willing to tell you? Or will they hide it because they're afraid? If they hide it because they're afraid of what you would do, then of course the time when they need their mother and father the most, they won't avail themselves of the help. They're too scared to ask. And that is a terrible situation. And so, they're afraid of punishment. That's why we hide the truth. But for a stream winner and above, what punishment is there? There's no self, no guilt. You don't send yourself to the lower realms, which is one of the reasons why the stream enter, if they made a mistake, they let people know. And I really enjoy telling about my mistakes because it makes people laugh. And they think that Ajahn Brahm is not, you know, is not sort of perfect. He wasn't born as a monk. No one's special. So all the story which I tell, all the silly things I've done. One of those recently, it was just in the last 12 months that I was teaching the annual retreat in Malaysia. And we held it in Genting Highlands, in the cave temple, you know, below the hotel. And during interview time, there was a couple came in, you know, a girl and a boy. And the girl did most of the talking about her meditation and stuff, and the boy was quiet. And you know, that happens quite often, you see a couple just, I don't know why the girl does all the talking. That's what I experience anyway, I don't know. But anyway, at the end of the conversation, you know, and the girl was always turning around to the boy, you know, just for, you know, confirmation or something. And at the end of the conversation, I was, you know, "Is that your boyfriend?" At which time they both burst out laughing. "So that's not my boyfriend, that's my dad." And she looked about, you know, early 20s, but she was only 16. And he looked maybe 30s, but he was about 45. But both of them, after finishing laughing, were so flattered. The girl, if you remember being a 16-year-old girl, you'd love it when people think you, you know, in your early 20s. You know, if you're older than that, you know, you want to, you know, be regarded as younger. But for a young teenager to think they look like they're 23 or something, that was such a compliment. She loved that. But for the father to think that he looked young enough to be like the husband of this young girl, oh, he loved her even more. And after apologizing for my mistake, they laughed. But 5 minutes later, they came into the room with an ang pao. I think it was, I don't know how much, $50, I think it was, $100. And with it was a little note, thank you, Ajahn Brahm, please use some of this to go to the optician and check the prescription of your glasses. So our monastery made some money out of that. We had a good story and laugh. And so it's wonderful, you make mistakes and you laugh about it. You tell people, oh, it's just beautiful. It's real. But, you know, if you just hide all your mistakes, you don't learn from the other things. You probably, most of you heard this story before, but it's a wonderful story about making mistakes and learning from them. And that was the time, must be a couple of years ago now, I went into Royal Perth Hospital, one of the main hospitals, asked from a Chinese disciple whose, I think his grandfather or uncle was, you know, on the ICU and, you know, was, you know, dying, was really seriously ill. And the chances were, the prognosis was not good. So they wanted me to go and chant for their patriarch of the family. So I went there and I did some really strong chanting. But it is true that, you know, I'd learned from Ajahn Chah, whatever you do, give everything you've got. Sometimes you get tired, but, you know, most of the time you get everything you've got and you get energy afterwards. So I gave some really strong chanting, really sort of as much as I could, and it was actually amazing. It worked. You know, the fellow started recovering. Almost like a miracle. But that is when I got in trouble. Because the family started scolding me. They were very upset at me. Because they'd expected this elderly gentleman to die. They'd made all the funeral arrangements with the funeral company. And all the relations had come from overseas, from Singapore, Hong Kong, Malaysia, I don't know where, mainland China. They'd all come together at the time of this elderly gentleman's passing away. And now this monk had come and spoiled all their arrangements and plans. Many of them will now have to go back overseas and come back again next time, every 6 months or a year, when he dies properly. And they said, Ajahn Brahm, we didn't want you to chant so he recovers. We wanted you to chant so he can have a peaceful death. I said, well, you should have told me. So it was one of my mistakes. But I learned from my mistakes. So every time I go to an ICU now, I ask the family, what type of chanting do you want? Is it die peaceful chanting or recover chanting? So I'd never make the same mistake again. That's a true story. But that's why, you know, that when you sort of don't have a sense of self, you know, you can just have fun. You make a mistake and you learn from it. You don't have this sense, I've got to cover it up. They better not know what I've been doing. But you just let people know. Anyway, I've been so usually that... Yeah, it's old habit. Sometimes you can say things. Sometimes people misunderstand what you say. I've already mentioned to you, many of you, I said, get lost. And if you understand what I mean, it's just actually encouraging you to lose your attachments and be free. But other people say, that's really rude. A monk shouldn't tell me to go and get lost, because in English, you know, that's like a rude word. But, you know, you use these things. And if you understand, it's, no, you're not sort of being offensive. So anyway, that's sometimes street winners, watchdogs, non-returners, incapable of hurting others by words or deeds. It looks like maybe you're hurting, but you're not really. I've been trying to care for my flu and tonsillitis for the past few days, giving them loving kindness, and just letting them be, but I still can't seem to be as mindful and meditate long. What do you mean meditate long? There's no long, there's only this moment. So stop counting the minutes, that's just going off into the future. I often notice that when you're in this moment, time has no meaning. For time to have a meaning, you have to measure something. You have to have it's the time is the distance between now and the future, or the past and now, or the past and the future. It's a measurement. The length of time you meditate, how old you are, how long this talk has been going on for. You have to have a measurement of some perception of the past and the future to have, you know, what we really know as time. But in this present moment, just time has a different experience. Just basically just not as you really are used to it. So then you can't meditate long. You don't have to meditate long. Long has no meaning. You just now. What do you do now? You just whatever's in front of you, the ache, the pain, the tonsillitis, is the most important thing in the world. Right now, just care for it. That is meditation. Powerful stuff. You know the law of karma in Buddhism? Is if you do good acts, acts of kindness, gentleness, generosity, selflessness, peace, whatever, kind acts, will always give good effects afterwards. And I always like the idea of like meditation karma. So right now, if you're being kind to this moment, you're making good karma to your mind, with your mind. If you're just being here, not wanting anything, not getting ill will, not trying to beat something up, it's good karma. Good meditation karma. And you know it's going to happen. After a while, the meditation karma gets enough, you get these incredibly peaceful states of mind. So if you try and get rid of something, if you get upset at something, if you get negative and try and get rid of something, that's bad karma, it's bad mind states. And that's going to cause bad meditation in the future. So if you've got tonsillitis, just be with it. If you can't beat them, join them. And that means, after a while, there's no problem anymore. The only time they seem to disappear is when I'm unconscious, asleep. Well, at least you can sleep. So I'm starting to feel frustrated. Oh dear, please advise what I should do. Nothing. Just be kind. Now that seems to be a bit weird, but after a while when you get this and you train yourself to be with a cough or tonsillitis, don't think that's not meditating. You're making good meditation come. You're doing the best you possibly can in the situation. And eventually it will happen. You get into a really nice deep meditation. And it's amazing that people say, oh, I've never meditated long before, but you make the good karma and then one day the tonsillitis eases off or the flu or the cold just gets a little bit better, which it does. Sickness doesn't last. And you're sitting there and wow! 2 hours, 3 hours, I've never done that before. 3 hours meditation, you didn't do it, it just happened. You feel so great. It's teaching you something. Where did that come from? Oh, one of the old meditation stories, but it's good. And it's relevant here. There was a refugee came to Australia. He went to Sydney. And, you know, he was, you know, highly educated, very skilled, but when you come to a new country, you just have to start again from the bottom. So he started again getting a job as a labourer on a building site. He worked so hard all day. At the end of the day, when he went home, his wife asked how much you earned today. He said, nothing, they didn't give me anything, I really worked hard. I said, oh, maybe you should work harder tomorrow. So on Tuesday, he really worked so hard on the building site. When he came home, he said, still didn't get anything. Oh, maybe they're just testing you out. So Wednesday, he worked, and Thursday too, and he still got no money. And on Thursday evening, he thought, people in Australia, they just exploit refugees. They don't really care for them. I'm not going to go to work anymore. What's the point? I really worked hard, 4 days, I get nothing. But his wife said, oh, just go on Friday as well, just see what happens. And at the end of the day on Friday, it wasn't actually a full day's work. He could knock off early, and the boss gave him this huge pay packet. And he went home very happy, and he told his wife, I've now figured out how it works in Australia. From now on, I'm only going to go to work on Fridays. Now, that little joke and story, which is an original Ajahn Brahm, it's the reason for that is we think that, oh, I can't meditate because you haven't got any pay today. But what you do today, making good meditation karma, maybe tomorrow, or maybe even tomorrow you don't get a paycheck. But you know that you are building up your credit, and after a while the paycheck will have to come. So if you've got cold or flu, just do what you need to do. Be peaceful, be kind, be gentle. This moment is the most important. That's good meditation karma. And the check will come. And sometimes you say, wow, I meditated. It was wonderful. Best meditation ever. But please see where that came from. All those other meditations where you did the good meditation karma. That is what produced a beautiful meditation. Don't sort of somehow separate out the good meditation and the bad. Bad meditation, just forget about those. No, that was actually working, that's building up credit. Anyway, next question. Given there are so many branches of Buddhism with different methods, such as meditation versus ritual versus chanting, is one method better than the other in realizing enlightenment? Please clarify. There are many different sects of Buddhism, but as a practicing celibate monk, I don't believe in sex. Ha 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 ha. So, the different branches of Buddhism. Which is the best? Just before the Buddha passed away, there was this wanderer asked the Buddha a series of questions, one of which was, in other religions past, which were there in India at the time, can you become enlightened? There was the Jains, there was other ascetics around at that time. Can they become enlightened as well? And the Buddha gave this very, very beautiful answer. And sometimes, you know, you have faith in the Buddha, but sometimes, wow, you know, that is an incredibly wise being who just answered so perfectly. And his answer was, in whatever religion, spiritual practice or path, or whatever branch of Buddhism, to relate it to this question, in whatever branch of Buddhism you find the Eightfold Path being practiced, there you will find stream winners, once returners, non-returners or arahats. It doesn't matter what you call it. It doesn't matter what the name of the path is or the name of the branch or whatever. What matters is what you do. You practice. Wherever you practice the Eightfold Path, you let go, let things be, allow things to disappear. It doesn't matter what you call that. There you will find stream winners, once returners, non-returners, or arahats. Very beautiful. So it doesn't matter if you call it, you know, the Pure Land Tradition or Mahayana Zen, or Christianity, or Sufi Islam, or whatever you call it. It's not what you call it. And if these are causes and effects, if you put those causes, the right view, what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow, probably right motivation, the meditation, mindfulness, if you put that in place, this is what happens. If you walk from Bodhinyana Monastery westward, you will come to the ocean. It doesn't matter whether you walk or you skip or you crawl or you cycle or you skateboard. If you keep going west, you come to the Indian Ocean. It doesn't matter what you call it. It's the way you go. So that meant, you know, we weren't criticizing this religion or another religion, this path and another path. My path is better than your path. Mine is a fast path. Yours is a slow path. Yours is a path for intelligent people. Mine is a path for the slow idiots. It doesn't matter about that. It's what you do. And if you're practicing the Eightfold Path, then it works. It's beautiful. I love that one because it's not criticizing a religion or a people or a gender or a race. This is part of, this is in the Ranawibhanga Sutra, I quote this so often these days, you never criticize a person for doing something wrong. You never criticize a religion for doing something wrong. You criticize doing something wrong. I first heard this in a psychology lecture many years ago, the story of the two children at the supermarket checkout. One dropped a jar of honey, and almost the same time, in the next aisle, the other kid dropped a carton of milk. And both went splat on the floor, made a big mess. The mother of the kid who dropped the honey said, "You stupid kid." The mother of the kid who dropped the carton of milk said, "That was a stupid thing you did." You know, you can probably relate to that, and that may have happened to you a few times. People call you stupid. Another one said, "That was a stupid thing you said." One puts the whole person down. I'm hopeless. I'm just not good enough. Stigmatized. And the other one just focuses on the act. "That was a stupid thing you did, but you're not a stupid person." It's a totally different response with different results. So, we never actually criticize a religion or a part of a religion. We criticize bad speech or bad action. That's all. That's beautiful. It means that there's a sense of focusing on the fault, not on the person. So we don't say, "You're a lazy bum, you haven't come to the morning meetings for such a long time." We never actually say that because that means that's very offensive. We say, you know, it's, you know, being lazy is not sort of a very advisable thing to do. So focus on the laziness or the bad speech or speaking too much, not on the person. Do you understand that? That is so effective. So never sort of compare my branch of Buddhism with your branch of Buddhism. Or your non-branch of Buddhism, or you haven't even got a branch of Buddhism, you've just got a twig. Yeah, that's the sort of stuff people do, which is really funny. Could you please share with us what your own practice was like in the beginning? E.g., what kind of mistakes did you make? Oh, made many. Where did you ask a lot of questions? Did you push yourself and experiment before understanding non-striving? Just for inspiration, absolutely. You know, because sometimes you work. One of the things was sloth and torpor. You know, dullness. I was just the first years in Thailand. I was always just so dull, and I didn't know why. And so I thought it was a personal error, personal mistake. I wasn't putting enough effort in. So you get up there early in the morning, and you sit there, and you'd really try really hard. You know, to get in the push and really watch the breath, and you're not going to miss anything. Okay, this is, I really got to watch the breath. Really effort. Come on, you can do this. So you try other tricks. One of the tricks, I haven't got it here, but the matchbox tray trick. So, had a matchbox, didn't have many things in that monitor, had matches. So you take off the cover, and you have the tray with all the matches in, and you put it on your head. Because if you started nodding, it would fall off, and the matches would make a noise. So you get like feedback. And so it only was after about 3 or 4 days I cured my sloth and torpor. Amazing. The matchbox was on the head and stayed on top of the head without falling off for the whole of the meditation. And that's where one of my friends took me aside. Actually, they shouldn't have been looking at me. They should have been closing their eyes meditating. Fault finders, but they really helped because they said, Ajahn, I've been looking at you. I found out why the matchbox doesn't fall off your head. You see, you're still nodding, but instead of nodding the normal way, you're nodding like this. And that was absolutely true. I've seen other people doing that. And it was just, I really thought I'd got somewhere and I hadn't. But then, one of the reasons why, when it worked, was that, I think I mentioned this, I was going over to Bangkok to do visas. And we had this air-conditioned room. And obviously good food. And, you know, it was richer food, more sustaining. And so you went there and got up at the same time, 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, in the hall by 3:15. No sloth and torpor at all. I was really alert. And why? And then you started to think, it's not a personal failure, having sloth and torpor. It was all it was I was an Ang Mo, you know, a Westerner, who's not used to that climate. It's in the jungles. It's hot, even in the early morning. You know, and like this temperature right now, this is pretty good now. This is how I like it. But when I, you know, you're all freezing, aren't you? So when I go to Singapore and meditate, I'm sweating. And I can't believe it. You go to a retreat, you know, which in Singapore, which you run, you know, and I'm sweating and you still got blankets on. It's just, you know, we're made in different places. But so when I was in an air-conditioned room and eating, you know, more nutritious food and having a bit more sleep, I wasn't sleep deprived. I had sort of nutrition and had climate which was supportive and so easy to meditate. So I realized that sloth and torpor was not a personal failing, it was just cause and effect. So you didn't think, I'm useless, I'm hopeless, I'm failing. That is a problem with striving. You do the striving, you choose to do it, so when you fail you think it's your fault. You didn't try hard enough. Didn't that happen at work? Or at school, you're not trying hard enough, so extra studies, tutorials out of school. Come on, work harder. Come on, you can do it. Come on, come on! And that's just ruined so many people, especially kids. And instead of that, find out why. What's the problem? And the problem was something very easy to understand. So then after that, when I went back to the forest, I just sat down there. It's cause and effect. And especially the main cause was I was trying so hard, I had low energy, and I was wasting all that energy fighting something. When you realize it's cause and effect, it's a waste of time fighting it. Just be with it. Let it be. And so, my sloth and torpor was the most important object in the whole world. And I cared for it. Instead of trying to get rid of it, just care for it. Yeah, it was in the moment, not that mindful, but, you know, mindful enough just to leave it alone. And then making things. You know, it's down here, and then my body straightened up all by itself. It was automatic, and I never decided to do it. And that was really weird, because in my previous experience, there are some things which are automatic, like your breathing, just like your heartbeat, and other stuff in your body which regulates this and regulates that. It's autonomous, you don't have to make a decision. But moving my body, it was always, you know, under my control. Now it did it by itself. And that was weird. But I realize you don't have to try, the body looks after itself. And oh, I'm going off these really interesting parts of meditation. Because I've taught non-striving, not controlling and letting things be, whatever happens. Years and years ago, in the North Perth Meditation Retreat Center, somebody, you know, just tapped me and said, look at that girl over there. And it was worrying, because she was contorted while she was meditating. I mean, just really twisted, you know, to the point where, you know, I was concerned for her. Because if I demonstrated that now, I would break bones, you'd have to send me into hospital for rehab. It was just really extreme. And then as we waited for her to come out, and you know, when she came out, she straightened up again, and I took her aside, you know, in a quiet place. So I did so, and said, are you okay? I was really concerned. She said, I feel great. I said, you were really twisted. And oh, so was I. I never knew that. I said, yeah, I mean, really. And then, you know, you got the eureka. Oh, okay. Did you have, like, a car accident or something? Yes! I almost died. You know, the car was a write-off. I was in hospital for such a long time. Oh, okay, got it. Her injuries hadn't totally healed yet. But when she let go and let her body do what it needed to do, when she butted out, got out of the way, then her body twisted around, because that's the only way that the channels of energy to get where they needed to do the healing. But when she was watching and controlling stuff, she would not be able to let the body heal itself. That's what it was doing. Your body is just so smart if you give it a chance and let it be. And from that time on, you see people just, they're twisted around, and they don't know what they're doing. They're all over the place. So sometimes they're nodding, you know, but, you know, they're not sleepiness. And after they say, oh, it's a really beautiful meditation. And said, it just, the body's just doing something, what it needs to do. Balances its energies or whatever. And they only, you can only do that if you don't control. Otherwise, oh, something's wrong. I shouldn't be twisted. Come on, straighten up. That's the problem with people. So, now those are little practices which you learn. I already mentioned about the sexy hour and how just, that really blew me away, that just how easy it was. I was feeding the negativity which was actually making all those stupid thoughts come up. You go to bed at night, sometimes you can't sleep because you're trying to sleep. You want to sleep. And that trying, that causes tension in the mind and the body. You want it. Already people have started talking about you get into a certain stage of meditation, you can't go further. Isn't it obvious? Because you want to go further. Give up. Let go. This is good enough. Don't want anything. Sometimes we do chanting, and there's this chanting of the Metta Sutta in English. And it says, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. Let them be contented and easily satisfied. I love that line. That is deep. Are you contented? Or you think, crikey, 3 days have gone. I haven't got anything yet. Just be satisfied with what you have. This is good enough. Yeah, you've only got to, haven't really got to the first stage of meditation yet. You've just only got to the stage of sitting down. That's as far as you've got. Great, that's contented, good enough. You're here, that's good enough. You know, who wants more? So, when you're content and easily satisfied, you know that sometimes people, they just get nimittas, beautiful. But that's, I want the jhanas. And sometimes I come and say, yeah, I got first jhana last. I want second jhana. I want second. I want second jhana. Crikey, first jhana is enough. I mean, a lot of people are just, oh, first jhana, I love first jhana. This person, they just want second jhana. There's no satisfying some people. Which is true, just that wanting, that craving. That's the problem. So that, you know, you learn just how to let things be. You can see just how the ego, the sense of self, just wants more. When you let go, the sense of ego disappears. What do you want? There's no one to do the wanting. Oh, freedom at last. Anyway, that's the sort of stuff. Pushing yourself. Yeah, of course I pushed myself. And then in the end you realize that was not getting you anywhere. Just getting you so tense. And Ajahn Chah kept on telling you, you come here not to attain things, but to let go of things. See how much stuff you can free yourself, lose all attainments and stuff. But, you know, you didn't believe him because, you know, you knew better. I went to Cambridge, for goodness sake. You know, he only did grade 4 at school. So, but, you know, one of the things, after a while, you thought, what's the point, you know, of going and getting a Nobel Prize where this person, only 4 years of school, knows far more than I ever know? It was really humbling, humiliating even, just to see someone who's really enlightened and wise. And just all my knowledge, just total waste of time. 2 nights ago, I dreamed. Oh, wonderful. Thank you ever about this question. Amazing. Oh, you've got me here. This is a much better joke than I've written. 2 nights ago, I... The trouble with jokes, I can't finish them before I laugh, because I know the punchline. 2 nights ago, I dreamed I was a piece of ravioli. Piece of ravioli. Last night, I dreamt I was a piece of spaghetti. Are these my pasta lives? Oh, I'm so jealous of you. I wish I'd have thought of that. Well done. Whoever said that deserves to be my disciple. That will go around Bodhinyana Monastery tomorrow. Brilliant. Meditation isn't as easy as what you make it out to be. If you want to make it hard, you can. You need a lot of patience. Some days you just go on and on like a flat tire. Sometimes you catch a glimpse of some brightness, it's back to square one again. Is there a faster, more effective way to meditation? Stop wanting things. Be satisfied. Just make peace right now. Because thinking about it is the hard part. Doing it, this is so easy. You know that sometimes I look at my meditation like as a default position. Just how I work when I've got nothing else to do. You're not teaching, you're not sort of at the computer answering emails, you're not interviewing people. So you go back to your room, what do? Nothing. Default, you switch off the electricity, switch off the doing, turn everything down, and just sit there. And again, because the will stops, everything stops. One of Ajahn Chah's similes, again, I haven't said this one yet, but he'd wave his hand up and down like this. Didn't have any visual effects, any PowerPoints or computers or anything. So he just had whatever he could lay his hands on. Or in this case, his own hand. He waved it up and down. He said, this is a leaf on a tree. It only moves because of the wind. If the wind stopped, eventually, not straight away, so would the leaf. Because that's its natural state to be still. Except if there's a wind. This is what we call these days its default state. It's perfectly still. So that's the same as the nature as the human mind. The human mind's default state is stillness. It only moves because of the wind. What is that wind? The wind of wanting. That makes the mind move. So that's why we let go. Leave it alone. Don't try and attain anything. No goals. Let go of wanting stuff. And then, when there's no wind, it's only a matter of time. The mind moves less and less until it comes to perfect stillness. Trouble is, sometimes it gets almost still, and then I want it to be more still. Oh, my other simile. Okay, now we have a senior nun here. So you can actually be my assistant. You can't see. You don't need to see. Just believe what I tell you to do. Okay, Carol, you can come up. You've done this before. Okay. This is my mind, the water. And my job now is to keep the water perfectly still. Meditation, samadhi. So, Carol, is the water perfectly still yet?
No.
I'm not paying attention. I'm not mindful. So I'm now going to be mindful.
It's
still moving?
Moving even more.
Yeah, so now, okay, because you know what? I'm not concentrating. I'm now going to be mindful. I'm going to concentrate.
It's moving even more.
That's how many people meditate. Mindful, concentrating. And they get so frustrated. That water never becomes still. Ajahn Brahm says it's so easy, but it's not. It's difficult. So what do you do? Concentrate even more. Come on. I'm going to get this. And that's how many people meditate. You get very frustrated. Of course, that's not the way to meditate. How to meditate? Put it down. Relax. Chill out. That's still moving. Listen, 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 this. Listen, 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 this. Listen, listen, this. How's that? Yeah. I could never hold it that still. But be careful, because sometimes you put it down. Is it still yet? No, not yet. Still yet? Come on. Come on. That's actually letting go. Not grasping. Detaching. Putting things down. The third noble truth, the four ways of letting go. Giving up. Renouncing. Freedom from having to do anything. Not allowing anything, any doing to occur. The second and third noble truth. There are two ways of meditating. And sometimes, just to trick people, is I just say, you know, what are the two methods of meditation? Vipassana samatha. No. If I ask a question, keep your hands down. They're always trick questions. So, the two types of meditation, second noble truth meditation, third noble truth meditation. Keep it just, you know, right to the core teachings of Buddhism. What is second noble truth meditation? What is the second noble truth? We described it a couple of days ago. Second noble truth, the cause of suffering, is wanting. So, if you're frustrated and suffering in your meditation, why? Is it because you can't do it? Or is it because you're doing second noble truth meditation? You're wanting something. Wanting causes suffering. So if you're suffering, you must be wanting something. If you're not happy with your meditation, it's because you want something. If you're not content and at peace, it's because you want something. There's nothing wrong with you. It's method. You're wanting something. It's not, I should be doing metta meditation or anapanasati, I should be doing the body, or maybe I should be walking meditation, maybe I should put those stupid teddy bears away and be serious for a change. No. It's the wanting which causes the suffering. That's second noble truth meditation. So people who get disappointed, get frustrated, have suffering, while they meditate, it's because you're wanting something. And that's amazing. You get to sometimes places in the meditation, you get really deep, and you can't go any further. Why? because you want something. So just check out, what do I want? Okay, that's what I wanted, seeing you, Mara, and then you go deeper. Third Noble Truth Meditation, Nibbana. Nibbanang paramang sukhang, said the Buddha. Nibbana is the deepest, ultimate happiness. So, if you're getting happy, peaceful, joyful, content, oh, that was a nice meditation, it means you've just been doing Third Noble Truth Meditation. Letting go of that wanting causes things to cease, disappear, happiness comes. Body vanishing, aches and pains, can't feel them anymore, sounds. All the thoughts, past and future, all vanishing, disappearing, ceasing. So happy. That's called Third Noble Truth Meditation. Those are really the only two types of meditation. When you want something, you get suffering. When you don't want anything, you're content. Easily satisfied. You're at peace. How easy meditation is when you don't want anything. Dear Ajahn, can you explain the nature, characteristics, and origin of the will? The nature of the will is never to let you rest. Always making you work. Always telling you you're not good enough, you can do more. Come on. It's 8:57. Come on, I can answer these questions quickly. So, it's like a person has been born in prison, lived all their life in prison. They know nothing but prison, and so they think prison's fun. It's not all they're used to. And the prison has got these five big walls, like the Pentagon. There's a reason why it's called the Pentagon. You know, like, the pentagrams is actually for black magic. Maybe that's the reason why. And that's conspiracy theories. I'm making that up as I go along. So anyway, five big walls of this prison. And you've got a sadistic prison guard whose name is Will. And those five big walls are the five senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And you've been imprisoned by those. And every time you try and escape from the five senses and the body, Will comes up. Don't do that. Do this. You've got to do that. Come on, you've got to do something. Don't be selfish. Always try harder. This is not good enough. And the will never lets you stop. It's so hard to allow the will just to calm down. We always think the will comes from ourself. But Professor Libet, L-I-B-E-T, some years ago, amazing experiments, it proved once and for all, what you take to be the will is not what originates thoughts, actions, and speech. He had people flexing their wrists whenever they wanted. But when they decide to flex their wrists, they press a button. So, allowing for reaction times, you can see when a person recognizes this thing which we call will. When you decide, when you choose, that's when they press the button. And there's a little delay there. But at the same time, they put some gizmos on the brain. And they found what we call the readiness potential. The readiness potential, part of the brain lights up. And it's, you can see it. Before you actually flex that particular muscle, there's a part of the brain actually lights up. So they could see actually when the brain, if you like, decides to flex the wrist. And the brain decided before you noticed the will, and then you flexed. That which you recognize as the will is not the originator of the effect. Something else comes first of all, and then the will happens, and then the effect. The point is that what happens first of all, we're not mindful of, we can't see. So it started, then the will is the first thing we can see, and then the effect, we associate the will with the effect, the will with the effect. So we think the will created things. If you look at the, what's it, Brahma Nimantana Sutta, there the Buddha also says, when Brahma first arose in this world cycle, in this universe cycle, this eon, that Brahma, the first to fall down from another state of existence into this newly created universe, and then other beings appeared afterwards, and that Brahma thought that he was the creator of these beings. There was a will, beings came, and he thought that his will created those beings. But it wasn't. Something else happened first, then there was the will, then there was the effect. It's a myth of control. It's just, what is it? Correlation rather than causality, if you know statistics. A good example of that is the tobacco industry. They did a report, a very good statistical analysis, which actually showed people who smoked had far less incidence of Alzheimer's disease. It was convincing. It had the statistics there. Smokers, far less incidence of Alzheimer's. Until someone realized that's correlation, that's not causal. Because the cause was people who smoked didn't live long enough to get Alzheimer's. So correlation and causality can often get confused. Another example of that was a California study some years ago, which showed that people who drank red wine had far less incidence of cardiac disease. It was very clear. And as a result of that, many people actually started drinking alcohol, especially red wine. Until someone looked at that study again. There was correlation, but it wasn't causality. The cause was something outside of that. Because they saw that the people in California who drank red wine were actually at a higher socioeconomic level. So they compared people of the same income level who drank red wine and those who didn't. And they found that those people of the same income level who drank red wine compared to those who didn't had far greater incidence of cardiac disease. It wasn't a red wine. It was those people who could afford red wine could afford better health insurance and health benefits and practices. It wasn't a wine. It was something else caused that correlation. The cause was they were wealthier. So wealthy people can afford red wine, but it means they also get better health outcomes. Be careful, cause and effect. So what will is a correlation. Something else is causing that. One place where I first learned that, which was scary to me, I never anticipated this. A student, I joined three societies, the Buddhist Society of Cambridge, the Astronomical Society of Cambridge, and the Psychic Research Society of Cambridge. And many of you saw me with my mate Bernard Carr, this close disciple of Professor Hawkins, who came to our conference over here 3 or 4 years ago. 2 years, was it? 2 years? Two years, okay, that's all. Only 2 years ago. Yeah. And we were best friends because we went to the same things. You know, he was a theoretical physicist, he was a Buddhist, he was in the Psychic Research Society. And so we did all the same things together. So that we kept meeting one another. But we went to a lecture, and the lecture, hypnosis, and you know, you're an 18, 19-year-old, a bit of fun and games, not taking life seriously. But there was part of that lecture demonstration which really shook me. And that was when they hypnotized one of the students. I, you know, volunteered to get hypnotized, but I wasn't a good subject. There's always one who is. And they get him to do, like, stupid juvenile things. Take off your trousers or something. You know, and just we thought that was incredibly funny, you know, being sort of adolescent students. But then, you know, this guy who had hypnosis, he told him, and I remember seeing this, he said, when I touch my right earlobe, doesn't matter where you are, what's happening, you're going to stand up and sing in a loud voice the British national anthem, starting with God Save the Queen, when I touch my earlobe. And he took him out of hypnosis. And of course, he didn't remember anything. We did. And being just not very helpful, we wouldn't tell him what the instructions were. We wanted to see if it was going to work. And eventually, you know, the hypnotist was a bit of an entertainer, because he put his hand close to his ear and then he scratched his mouth, and it was just getting us anticipating. But eventually, he during the middle of his lecture, he touched his right earlobe. And this student stood right up, and in a loud voice, he sang God Save the Queen from beginning to end, where all the students were howling with laughter. He wasn't embarrassed at all. He just sang and sang during our howls and ridicule of him until he was finished. We thought it was a great joke until the hypnotist calmed us down and said, why did you do that? And this student gave a reason, a logical, no, quite believable reason why he did that. And that's when I got the goosebumps. Because I realized that student had no choice. He did the most ridiculous thing, and he thought it was his own will. Later on, that readiness potential, that was already programmed into the brain. And then he had a will appear to justify it, and then he did it. And it was clear to me that that thing he called his will, which he explained, he justified it, was not the cause of singing the British National Anthem. But he thought it was. He had been brainwashed and conditioned. And then a lot of things came up which started to really concern me. There was the occasion where I saw, okay, it goes on a bit, but this is fascinating stuff. I saw an advert. Still remember the name, some Bruno tobacco. I didn't smoke cigarettes, but it was actually cool to have a pipe. You know, like a pipe, you know, with a little bowl in the end you put thing, because that was like many people who were intellectuals had pipes. You know, Albert Einstein had a pipe, and just, you know, that was actually a cool thing to have. Sorry, who else? Tony Benn, yeah. What's his name? Howard Wilson. They all have pipes. And anyway, so I saw in the advert St. Bruno tobacco, and the advert was absolutely banal, juvenile. This ordinary looking guy, you know, young guy, was walking down the street, and then he got out the pipe, put some Bruno tobacco, lit it up, and then the aroma passed like a newsagent. And it was this impossibly beautiful girl, you know, serving behind the newsagent's counter. You know, there's no girl that beautiful would ever be in such a lowly job, but no, she was. She jumped over the counter, totally entranced, following after this ordinary-looking guy, you know, waiting to do his every will, like a young man's fantasy. Then they passed some greengrocer's shop, and another beautiful brunette got entranced by the smell of some Bruno tobacco. And after about 1 minute, this whole, you might only call it a harem of incredibly beautiful young women were following this ordinary-looking guy because St. Bruno tobacco is irresistible to the opposite sex. Now, that's absolutely stupid, isn't it? And I was intelligent. But I own up. I bought some. And I went down the street of Cambridge with my pipe. And the only person to follow me was a dog. No women jumped over the counter to follow me. Now you think that's stupid, but that's an exaggeration. But why have you got your hairstyle like it is? Why do you actually just wear the clothes you do? Why don't so many women these days, they wear holes in their jeans? And you have to pay extra for that. Why? Brainwashed. And we think it's our free choice. That's the problem with advertising. Usually, I've been told, for every dollar a firm invests in advertising, they get $3 back. It's great returns. Look at the adverts you see on TV. I don't think, sometimes people actually show me some of the really funny adverts. Juvenile, who would believe in that? Everyone does. It's so stupid, you think no sensible person would believe in that. That's why it gets under your radar, under your defense systems. You think it's only a joke. That's why you buy stuff. You are conditioned. I admit that for 3 or 4 days I've been brainwashing you. I admit that Ajahn Chah did the same to me. It works. It's good brainwashing though. Brainwashing you to let go and stop striving. You are not in control. You think you are. That's a delusion. You think the will is the person or the being or the thing which controls your life. But other things control your will. It's not the originator of actions. No more than God started the universe. Things he did. Will, results, correlation, but it's not causal. Anyway, if there is office politics where people fighting for power, no integrity, jealousy going on, etc., what is the right attitude to face such a situation? Kind of tiring dealing with such behaviours every day at work, because indirectly I fall into the trap too, or should I quit the job? I say fighting for power, you can take the power. In other words, if somebody wants promotion, they're stupid. Haven't you got enough stress in your life already? So, don't ask for promotion. Stick in the job you're in now. Or ask for downsizing. Demotion, please. So, in other words, if you get promoted and you go up the corporate ladder, whatever it is, does that make you happier? Just get more work to do. Haven't you not got enough work already to do? But you get more money. Doesn't matter how much money you have, it's never enough. If you actually earn more money, you've got to get a bigger car. You've got a bigger apartment, better clothes. You end up, you still haven't got enough money. So better the not enough money you have now than the not enough money you have after you get more stress. So office politics is stupid. You want the top job, it's yours. Who wants a top job? Anyway, people fighting for power, no integrity, jealousy going on. You just be kind. And just what other people do, you become invulnerable. People call you an idiot, they try and accuse you of things you haven't done. Okay. If somebody accuses me of something I haven't done, I always remember Ajahn Chah's simile. If someone calls you a dog, you don't need to actually to fight back. I'm not a dog. All you need to do is to look at your bottom. See if you've got a tail. If you ain't got a tail, you ain't a dog. Problem solved. So, that's how we deal with Sangha politics. Which of the five khandhas do we trash when we meditate? Trash or truck? What is that? Do we trash all of them? Or trust when we meditate? What experience the jhanas? What experiences the jhanas is just the five khandhas. And the jhanas are part of the five khandhas. It just experiences the last drop of five khandhas. It's the components of existence. We don't experience
itself, it's always self, it experiences the last moments of candor, which experienced the previous moment of candor. Actually, there's no such thing as a present moment. It's just the immediate past moment, which we can observe, know, and we call that the present moment. It's as close as it can get. So, when Descartes said, "I know, therefore I am," his crucial mistake there was time. I know, therefore I was. I was what? I was knowing something, doing something. So it's always, people think that's the proof of being, that you can know that you know. But the accuracy is, I know that I knew. The last moment becomes the object of this moment's consciousness. Dear Ajahn, I no longer can feel my hand, legs and the bear. Is this normal? It's absolutely abnormal. You better go to the doctor. We're just going to commit you into those perfectly normal. Things vanish and disappear. Perfectly normal. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle. You're watching the bear and things start to disappear. You're comfortable. You know that sometimes that I was actually a Singaporean years ago. They were meditating here and their hands disappeared. They freaked out. My hands are disappearing. Look, when you watch a movie or you watch Liverpool play Manchester United on TV, do your hands disappear as well? Well, actually, that's right. Because I'm not even paying any attention to them. I'm watching the screen. So when you're focusing, things vanish. What about when you go to sleep? Do your legs disappear when you go to sleep? And your hand? Everything disappears, isn't it? Good job. So it's perfectly normal, natural, just enjoy it. The less you have to worry about, the better. And I promise I will disappear soon. Dear Ajahn, why have we been ignorant for so many lifetimes? Why is it so hard to see the reality of all things accurately? You didn't have enough karma yet. But now, this is your lucky week. You have great good karma. You've heard good dhamma. So, it's not your fault. So don't blame yourself for being ignorant for so many lifetimes. I remember just somebody blaming me. He said, why did Buddhism spend such a long time before it came to Australia? That's unfair. Not my fault. So we always have what we call passing the buck. It's Ajahn Chah's fault. You should have sent me here earlier. Or sometimes people say, why does Ajahn Brahm tell such bad jokes? It's not my will. It's not my fault. My father told bad jokes. Because my father told bad jokes, he was actually conditioned me to tell bad jokes. One of his jokes, this guy goes to the hospital, this is many years ago, and when he went into the, he had a motorbike accident, and the triage nurse, straight into the emergency department, had to amputate one of the legs. It was not savable. And apparently it happens today as well. When they got him out, they realized they'd amputated the wrong leg. Even actually these days, people tell me this. I've been in hospital for a long time. Actually, the nurses actually write on the leg, this one. So the surgeon actually gets the right one off. See anything like that. But anyway, so they had to amputate the other leg. And so once he was able, he got a lawyer and he sued the hospital. He sued them, but he lost his case. He didn't have a leg to stand on. Now that was told by my father. I remember that. He just really got me. Oh, that's terrible. He didn't have a leg to stand on. Oh, crikey. That's my dad. So the reason I tell jokes is not my fault. He brainwashed me, conditioned me. So it's nice to pass the buck, there's no self. So why have you been ignorant for so many lifetimes? I don't know, it's pass the buck to somebody. Thank you for the fascinating history on Jesus. However, I'm still at a loss as to whether or not practicing parts of the past, especially jhanas, can be done rightly without right view. You know that, actually it was Handaka over in Indonesia. Now, he's got some books published by this Anthony de Mello or something. And there was a passage in there when he was describing some experiences he was doing. And, you know, if it's not jhana, it's pretty close. And how did he do that? Because he was a Christian. And it really made sense with some of those medieval Christians, I've seen people like St. John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, because what they were doing, it looked to me that they were doing some jhana stuff. Teresa of Avila would actually float up into the rafters while she was doing a chant. She was blissing out. And of course, no YouTube in those days. You couldn't video it. But, you know, all the people said sometimes they had to quickly grab her legs to stop her going too far and pull her down. So, you know, that is a sign of, you know, there's something going on there. And the reason why, you know, I can see how it works is, as a Christian, if you really are, you know, the powerful medieval type Christian, you would actually let go and let God take over. Your sense of self and control and will, you'd be able to let it go. Not many Christians can do that. Now, they may say that they believe in God, but no, they do it themselves. But to totally sit down and let go and let sort of God or nature, whatever it is, take over. If you do that full on, yeah, I can understand that letting go would allow the body to vanish, fear to vanish, control to vanish. And that's why it does actually say in the Psalms, be still and know that thou art God. Emerging with something. Of course, it's not the right view there, but still have the jhanas. Or at least the first jhana. Yes, and it is samadhi. You can say it's jhana by its qualities, but because it hasn't got the framework by which to understand it, jhana is not enlightenment. One of the favorite sayings, verse 372 of Dhammapada, Nati jhanang apanyasa panya nati ajayato yamhi jhanang chapanya chasa vai nibbana santike. When a similar question was asked at a retreat which I gave in Sri Lanka, and there's only six Mahanayakas, that's leaders of the Sangha, and one of them was there, you know, listening to my meditation instructions. And afterwards, you know, he said, oh, Ajahn Brahm's okay, because, you know, he can quote verses of Dhammapada, and he can actually chant the Pali accurately. Everything else I said, you know, was not as important as that gave me cred, you know, for Sri Lankan head. So, but what that means is that there is no wisdom without jhana. There's no jhana there's no wisdom without jhana. There's no jhana without wisdom. But where there's jhana and wisdom, jhana and panya, then you're in the presence of nibbana. So jhana and wisdom together, those two are what creates the enlightenment experience. Just the jhana is not enough. My similes was the jhana is like the flashlight. The wisdom is the map where the treasure lies. If you've got a flashlight, it doesn't matter how powerful it is, but no map, you never find the treasure. If you've got a map, but no flashlight, you can't use it. When you've got those two together, you can actually find the Dhamma. If one naturally walks while meditation, is this okay? I already mentioned that's the body doing its thing. Yes, meditation rocks. It's either that or you've got rocks in your head. Which is an Australian saying. And I better not say. How does one stop wanting? You can't stop wanting. You can't do it. You just let go. Have contentment. Looking at myself and people around me, we're only willing to stop wanting or let something go after experiencing. For example, after experiencing love, after having your own family, only then we say, I can let go, I cannot want. Otherwise, there's always that part that wants. What is wrong? Of course there isn't. Do you want cancer? Of course you don't want cancer. You don't have to have cancer before you realize it's not a good thing to have. Do you want, what else don't you want? Do you want to keep on hearing eternal bad jokes of Ajahn Brahm? I heard karaoke. What is it I've never done which, I've never joined an army. So, you know, do I have to join an army before I realize I don't want to join an army? So, no, you don't need that. You just understand what wanting, what it does. Just the underlying sort of imitation of wanting. You know, our world always encourages you to want more. You just go to the shops, it's advertising. You haven't lived until you've gone to the Grand Canyon. You haven't lived until you've, what else, you know, you're supposed to do? Bungee jumping. That's absolutely crazy. You know, on the end of a rope and you throw yourself off, you know, you should be in one of those sort of hospitals to do stuff like that. What do you want to do that for? Maybe somebody pushes you off. But, you know, that's their bad karma. But anyway. No, I'm not going to tell that terrible joke. So, the thing is, you don't have to experience it to know that it's another form of wanting. It's going to dissatisfy you. I was brought up on chips. 7 years living in Thailand, eating rice and rotten fish and frogs. I was a vegetarian before I became a monk. I would give anything for a vegetarian equivalent to a frog. Like, you know, like faux frog. But they have faux meat. But I went home to visit my mother. And in an English person's house in those days, you have to have the chip pan, the frying pan. And you remember this, Stephen, maybe, because same generation. Just this big pan with oil. You never change the oil. On the outside, it was golden, encrusted oil or fat for 7, 8, 10 years. That's when it started to get, you know, really delicious. It had the flavor. You never cleaned it. My goodness. And so, as soon as I walked into my mother's kitchen, there was a chip pan which I remembered for years before I became a monk. And I thought, wow, now I'm going to get some home-cooked food. Now that was my anticipation. And honestly, this happened. As soon as we walked into that kitchen and my old chip pan was there, she took one look at that chip pan and said, I've been meaning to throw this away for a long time. And right in front of me, she threw it away without ever making me any chips. Because I wasn't allowed to ask for anything, she got me some rice. It wasn't actually frog, for goodness sake, but some rice and curry. She said, oh, you've been in Thailand. That must be what you like. And I thought, I deserved that. All those years of anticipation and wanting and right in front of me. And I did get chips once. I was about 2 months, and that was from a Thai man. No one else gave me any chips. This Thai man invited me to his house for lunch, and he gave me some chips. I said, you know, it's only Thai people who gave me any chips. But then later on, when I came over here, and that's just chips, but no, the fish and chips, the real thing, you know, in newspaper. And Ajahn Jacare was here, and it was a funeral service, and he couldn't make it, so I had to go. And it was just timed that after the funeral service, I couldn't get back to the monastery for lunch. So he said, I'll just, you know, get the driver to, driver can get you something on the way. And this was my chance. This was it. I could had permission to go to a fish and chip shop, a real fish and chip shop, and get real fish and chips in newspaper, just like I used to have it. This was it. This was perfect. That was my dream. And then when I got it, I got tummy ache. And it wasn't what I expected. All my desires and fantasies were like unfaithful to me. They promised so much but delivered so little. That's what wanting does. When I get this, then I'll be happy. When you get it, you realize it's not exactly as satisfying as you thought it would be. That's the illusion of wanting. That's why that Oscar Wilde, the two tragedies, not getting what you want, yeah, I understand that, but getting what you want is suffering. And I heard this from a Middle Eastern man. He said there's two curses which are really, really bad, which people give one another in the Middle East. The second most powerful curse, I thought, was just very good use of language. And if ever you want to curse someone, you're very upset at somebody, your boss or something, you can tell them this. You say, "May the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits." Oh, it's a really bad monk that I could laugh at something like that, but at least it's got some class to it, you know, just sort of get lost. "May the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits." But the worst curse of all, and this is really deep, and I thought, wow, whoever did this one really understood. The worst curse of all, "May you get what you want as soon as you want it." That was a curse. And you think about that, contemplate that. That's devastating. If you want something, as soon as you want it, it comes to you. You can't survive. Because for most people, life is striving. Striving is what they understand as life. Working hard and getting something afterwards. If it just comes as soon as you want it, it's got no meaning anymore. Life is a journey. There's no journey, no distance between you and the destination. You're really stuffed. That's the illusion of wanting. Promises so much, but all it gives you is irritation, problems, difficulties. Never satisfied. Ajahn Chah called it the itch on the mangy dog. Wherever it goes, it carries the itch with it. So, you come here. Okay, yeah, I see. Wanting fame or fortune or more money or winning the lottery. Yeah, I see that. You know, that's not going to get you happy. We call that materialism. And then people come to a monastery or a retreat center, and we call it spiritual materialism. I want jhana. Which jhana have you got? I've got first jhana. I got second jhana. Na 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 na. I got better jhana than you have. People actually do that. Spiritual materialism, trying to attain things. The certificates. Sotapanna certificate. Last time I got anagami, this time I'm going for arahat. That's called spiritual materialism. It's wanting. And there's no peace there. There's no end to that. But contentment, you're at the end already. The end of wanting. Peace at last. The end of this talk. Silence. And I can now go and take a rest. Sadhu. 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 Okay. Have fun. Oh, there's a lonely teddy bear in the corner there. With broken leg, is it broken leg or bent legs?